the base, deep down, no precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition.
Wow, I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. Sugar and spice. I feel nice. A sugar and spice. So nice, so nice. I got you.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Melon. Whoa. These are hot mics.
Hot mics.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Ooh, here we go. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Mel and Floyd Summer Replacement Show. And I'm Mel, and back from assignment for one day today is Floyd.
Happy to be here.
Yeah. So, of course, here today, of course, is being the lobby of the Bartell Theater at 113 East Mifflin Street. We're streaming remotely during the Wisconsin Film Festival, which kicked off last night.
They've got us placed strategically between the restroom and the bar, so I think we'll be okay.
It's the circle of life.
It is.
So, Floyd, we have a script.
We have a producer. We have two engineers, three engineers, one back at the station. Oh, we lost you.
I'm gone. There we go.
Oh, good.
So we have a script today. We have the script today, so make sure we don't wander off.
I'll try not to.
Talking about strange things don't mean anything.
Like the eclipse.
Just going on and on. Nice tapestry they have here and everything.
Tracy said when you get nervous, you tell stories, so try not to do that.
Okay. All right. That's better.
Nothing but the best.
All right. So, anyway, I'm pretty sure they decided on that stickiness here once we told them that you were hosting.
It's not a bad idea. No. Ruby tells me that Wart's an official media partner with the Wisconsin Film Festival.
We are an official media sponsor.
That's a
partner.
Partner.
Partner, not a sponsor.
Not sponsor.
I think we're finally being recognized for our media prowess. We're very excited to be working with them on this special remote broadcast. We'll be talking with filmmakers from four films today. But first, we're kicking it off with our old friends, Lewis Peterson from Five Star Video. I called you Four Star earlier. I'm sorry.
Four Star is right.
Okay.
Yeah. Wait, can you explain why you lost a star?
Five stars is for hotels. Four stars is for movies based on the Roger Ebert rating system. Okay. And yes, I have been asked that probably several thousand times before.
And Ben Reiser here is also from...
Yeah.
From the film festival.
Are we going to be chatting over James Brown for the entire conversation?
I don't know. We need
is that how it works
down
here?
A little
That's
bit
pretty
if we
much
can.
How we do
it's
it.
But in
we're bringing it down here.
Yeah. So that's all right.
There we go.
I mean, I don't mind either way.
Yeah.
I mean, I normally talk over James Brown.
Right.
But I
just
thought
see your dance.
This was a special occasion.
So, Ben, you're the, what are you, the director?
Grand Poobah.
Poobah.
They call me.
Yeah.
I like Poobah status.
You know, we were working off a script last night at opening night for our Golden Badger Awards ceremony, and I wandered off script, and that led to your producer letting me know right before we got on air, hey, Ben, you know, you can't swear on this show.
It's radio. Yeah.
It's the government, the heavy hand of government. Yeah.
And actually, I don't have a script, so Lewis and I are flying blind.
Right. So
it's the way we like it.
Yeah.
So Ben, let's in broad terms, what's going on with the festival this year? What is there like a theme or is there the
theme is how many fantastic movies can we show to the good people of Madison over the course of 8 days, from Vilas Hall on campus all the way to the Easttown Mall and Flick's Brewhouse. We've moved east a little bit between Bartell, which is where we're sitting right now, and the Barrymore Theater, which we're at for the first time since 2017. And then, as I mentioned, our brand new venue replacing our AMC Hilldale venue, which closed last year. We're now over at the Easttown Mall at Flicks Brewhouse. We'll start there on Monday and go through Thursday over there while we continue on at the Barrymore. And then starting today, we're at all of our campus venues plus the Bartell. So 4070 Vilas Hall, the Chazen Museum of Art, the Marquee at Union South, and a brand new venue for us, which is, I also think, and I keep saying this, but I really made it up, but I think it might be true, the oldest building on campus, the Music Hall at the base of Bascom Hill. Looks like a church. It's got a clock tower. I don't think anyone's ever shown movies in it before, but we are doing that all this weekend.
Oh, very cool. North Hall, I think, is the oldest.
Well, whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, right. I'll fight
but
you.
But music oldest. Yeah.
I can make up facts better than anybody.
Okay. We can take this outside later.
Right. Yeah. Or to the bathroom.
Sure.
Or to the
bar. Which is convenient.
Yeah. So there's this Columbia's 100th anniversary.
Yes, that's true.
Right? So what's going on with Columbia? Now, Columbia, is that like kind of like, they were sort of like the B movie theater or
the B movie studio.
Not
really.
Oh, okay.
No.
Okay.
But there's a certain sleaziness to it. Yeah. Like we're showing John Carpenter's Christine, which was a Columbia release. That's nobody's idea of like an A-list John Carpenter movie. Yeah. But we've got a beautiful new what they call 4K restoration. It's going to be great to see that in theater again.
It's got a Chrysler in it.
And we're actually kicking off with a very much a B movie.
I told you they were B movie.
Yeah. Yes. 3:30 to, is it 1 o'clock? Maybe it starts soon. Tight Spot from the 50s with Brian Keith and who else is in that, Lewis? Help me, Lewis.
Is that the one with Edward G. Robinson? Or am
yes.
I thinking of
yes.
Oh, okay.
Edward G. Robinson.
All right. I did know the answer. I just didn't believe in myself.
Well, you've got to believe in yourself.
Which is a film I had never even heard of before, but I'm excited that we're showing it. And we've got, I think, about 10 Columbia releases from throughout the years. And we've got Rita Belda, who's sort of the main restorationist archivist over at Sony Columbia. And she grew up here in Wisconsin. And so every year these days, she comes back to the festival and presents some of the restorations she's been working on over the last year or two. And so this year it ties in with this Columbia anniversary. So we're showing a whole bunch of films with Rita, and she'll be introducing them and talking about them afterwards. It's going to be great.
You've got some real early Frank Capra stuff, too. What's going on with that?
Yeah, Frank Capra made some films for Columbia in the pre-talkie days. So two silent features from him, and we're going to have it with live piano accompaniment with our friend David Drazen, who always comes up from Chicago to do things like this. So that's, I think, Sunday morning. That's great. I'm psyched. I love Frank Capra. To get to see these sort of rare silent films of his is going to be a real thrill.
So, Lewis, what kind of what do you have your eye on as far as things you want to make sure you catch?
The number one movie I'm excited about is actually a movie I've seen many times before, but never in a fancy 4K restoration. Playing on Monday night at the Barrymore, The World's Greatest Sinner. Written, directed, and starring Timothy Carey. It's basically an affront to good taste and totally bizarre. A guy quits his job, changes his name to God, and says, "I'm running for president. If you vote for me, you'll live forever." And other notable thing is that it's soundtracked by Frank Zappa before anyone actually knew who Frank Zappa was in 1962. I believe.
Timothy Carey is one of those screen presences where he seems totally insane on camera, but you also get the sense that he's exactly like that off camera.
Yeah, well, and his son is going to be there, right? So we can confirm or deny that.
Yes.
The other one I'm very excited about is actually tonight, two screenings, The Tingler, with a reproduction of a 1950s William Castle Theater gimmick. Percepto.
Oh boy.
You're just going to electrocute people,
yes.
right? Is that how it goes?
Yeah, more or less. Yeah.
If it all works out.
I mean, I've asked, I've asked Ben, I've asked Jim Healy, I've asked Mike King, and I feel like I don't know. I feel like I haven't gotten any like definite information about this, which just makes me more curious of how it's actually going to work.
That's how it originally was in the 50s.
Yes.
It was a scary movie, this little blob would attach itself to your spine, and when it was scary, they would like give the audience little electric zaps in their chairs.
Yeah. You know, why would you want to know how it works?
I mean, right, no, I think just go with it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, fair enough.
And ruin the magic. Yeah.
Huh? And then talk to your doctor afterwards.
It'll cure your sciatica. That's all I can tell you. Yeah.
And I feel like I do have to... I was on the Golden Badger jury this year, so I feel like I have to plug at least a few of the Wisconsin-owned movies as well. I mean, the Golden Badger winners, Parallel Botany, Patient, and February. Right. I believe the director of February is appearing on this very program.
Yes, he will be here shortly.
Later. Yeah. Those are all excellent. I don't know if I have the show times right off the top of my head.
I think two of them are running against each other tomorrow afternoon, and then I think February is on Sunday. And they're all part of, all three of those films are shorts, so they're part of larger shorts programs. Parallel Botany is a short about botany, and it's playing in a program called Light Needs and Other Botanical Shorts. And Light Needs is a feature-length film about houseplants and people's relationships with their houseplants. It's kind of an interesting semi-experimental documentary. And then Patient is playing right here at the Bartel as part of a program called Americans Smell Good, plus Wisconsin.
They do not. Not in my experience.
Well, this is a documentary told from the perspective of a Turkish immigrant, Emir Kakaroş, who's a filmmaker who's had many films with us in the past. And this is a terrific documentary about his time for the last decade or so living in Milwaukee and some of the people he's met there. And there is a music video in the middle of this film that is a song about Americans smelling good.
Okay. We'll have
and
to look that
do you have television with that then? Yes.
No, okay. It's in Percepto.
All right, well, we got to wrap up here.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Ben, I know. So fast. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. Ben, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for stopping by.
You guys are the best.
Lewis, thanks for coming in from Four Star.
Four Star.
Yeah.
Four Star.
All right.
Save the extra star for Satan. Yeah.
All right. That's been Lewis Peterson, owner of Four Star Video, and Ben Reiser, Wisconsin Film Festival coordinator. Thanks to both of you guys. And thanks to both of you guys. He said, looking over at the reading from his script.
Oh, it's two-sided. It's
save the planet there,
there
baby.
We go. Okay, let's move on to our next film.
Yes.
It'd be the first film, Coup. It's a wealthy family isolating at a seaside estate during the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic when their newly hired chef cooks up more than an eggplant casserole. Here's a brief clip from the trailer.
I'm curious, Mr. Monk, which restaurant did you say you worked in prior to joining us?
It's just a little tavern. You wouldn't know.
Try me. No.
I tell you what, though, we made a damn good gin, Ricky. But if we had to shut it down with the closures.
I am very sorry for your loss.
At least I have my health. All right. Enjoy your Sikor.
Mr. Monk is an interesting fellow.
Ooh. Oh? But maybe a good cook?
Okay, that was joining us to talk about The Coup are the co-directors Austin Stark and Joseph Schumann. Before I say anything, I watched that screener. Billy Magnuson is astounding to me. He has this thing where he goes from this engaged and nice person to all of a sudden that his extra eyelid drops down. He goes blank and is just scary as all get out. I was going to say the only time I've seen that in actual people is ex-cons or Hell's Angels. So
That's psychopathic.
Yes, it was like he plays the befuddled psychopath just perfect.
Yeah, it can happen to the best of us, you know?
Yes, right.
Somebody else who does that well is Christian Bale in American Psycho.
Oh, right, okay. Right. It's just so hard to do. I don't, yeah, unless you're a psychopath, in which way comes naturally.
Billy's great.
He's awesome in the film.
Lucky that we were able to
That was a great cast.
Yeah, it really was.
Top to bottom. I've got to say, this isn't the booze talking. I really liked that movie a lot. I watched it yesterday, and it was like one of my favorite movies I've seen in quite a while.
In years.
So, thank you. Even if it were the booze, that's okay. we'll take what we can get.
Yeah. but it's hard to I was thinking about how to do this interview, and it's hard to talk about because it's kind of, you know, everything is sort of unveiled slowly.
Yeah.
You know, it starts out, the very first scene is kind of a mystery. It's like, what's this guy up to? He's acting very strange. But I hate to spoil it for anybody who's going to see it.
I just love the way the tension built.
It's a unique world between, you know, thriller and comedy that we were trying to balance. So by design,
I think you did that very well.
There were times when I was really terrified. I'm like, what's this guy gonna do, or what's gonna happen here? But it's set in 1918. Why don't you just tell us what the base, as much as you can say without ruining for us.
It's set in 1918, and a wealthy family is sheltering from the Spanish flu. They hire a new cook, and the cook spearheads a rebellion with his fellow staff to take over the house. And Austin and I were inspired to write this during the early days of COVID, although in no way do we see this as a pandemic film. I mean, the Spanish flu is just a sort of storm that gets our characters marooned on a deserted island. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it explores what happens in this upstairs, downstairs relationship between the staff and their employers when the social order stops functioning, if only for a brief moment. Chaos and mayhem ensues, and we found that very funny. So,
one thing I thought you did really well is something a surprising number of filmmakers and writers forget is it's the old adage of show, don't tell. And you know, you didn't just say this is a crazy guy, this is a psycho guy, this guy's a fraud or whatever. You know, you showed that, and as I say, you kind of peeled the onion, just showed the layers over time.
Who was those psychopath in Freud?
Well, all of them, several of them, I think.
Yeah, no, I think one of the things we set out to do was not create characters that were black and white,
right? Mm-hmm.
That were living in shades of gray, and all three of our lead actors, you know, Peter, Billy, and Sarah, to an extent, reflect that.
Yep, it just drew me in. I'm just going to go fanboy gushing here.
Gush really away, please.
Okay. I did. I love the way that it slowly unfolded and it relied on me to fill in the blanks, and then we get to the end, and I thought, wait, I did not see that coming.
Yeah, through a lot of it, you're sitting there going, "What the hell is going on here? What is this? These
and people are stealing
their
to?
People are stealing their turnips,
Where did that come from?"
So when you made this movie, and this has nothing to do with anything creative Floyd and I have ever done in the past, but sometimes you have a vision in your head of how it's going to be, and you just can't quite get it right to come out. Is this kind of how you envision it in your head, or did it take on a life of its own? Anything different? Or
I think both, strangely enough. Although it wasn't, you know, and I don't think it can ever be exactly as you imagine it will be. It actually, even though it wasn't that, it hit what we thought it could be even more so. And I think that's one of the joys of making these things is you arrive on set and you never quite know what you're going to get. And, you know, more often than not, we were more than pleasantly surprised by what we did get.
Yeah, I think our actors and our cinematographer certainly elevated what our vision was. I mean, they all did a phenomenal job, and we were blessed to be able to work with such talented actors. I mean, we have, you know, Billy and Peter, you know, two of the most talented actors working today. And so they certainly took it to another level. But, you know, what I will say, having made other films, is that this is probably closer in terms of what I imagined the finished film being than any other film I've made.
The cast and our DP share our warped and twisted sense of humor, and without that commonality, you know, so they sort of got it, and they knew the parameters of the absurd that we were working within. Mm-hmm. So we were blessed to have them.
How did you end up with this cast? What was the process for landing these guys?
We were looking at actors who were, when we finished the script, we knew that we wanted to shoot it within 6 months. And so we were looking at actors' availabilities, and one guy we had been thinking about while we were writing was Peter Sarsgaard, because he has this sort of cerebral quality where the gears in his brain always feel like they're turning, and he's kind of like, he could play twisted well. And at the same time, he's not often given the opportunity to play colorful characters. He's always playing these very like subtle, quiet, reserved characters. So we thought it would be really interesting for him. And then we, when we brought on our casting director and she checked availabilities, we saw that he, you know, wasn't working in the window that we wanted to shoot. And so we said, you know what, let's just take a shot. We had no idea if we could get him. Thankfully, his agent passed along the script. He read it and he loved it. We had a great meeting, and now we're good friends.
Okay, nice.
Yeah.
Where'd you shoot this? I didn't notice in the credits.
We shot it in New Jersey, and if anyone in the listening audience has never been to New Jersey, all of New Jersey looks exactly like it does in the movie.
Beautiful
mansion,
green,
you know, verdant, yeah. Mansion after mansion. Yeah,
that's how I had always
pretty much any actor.
Pristine.
There's three different mansions that we shot in order to get one cohesive mansion in the film. There was a one mansion that had an indoor pool that we shot at, one for interiors, the rest of the interiors of the film, and one for the outside.
The exteriors.
Did you work with like some historical society or something to?
No, there was a school called Georgian Court University that had this estate that they had preserved since the early 1900s that was donated to the college. And we were lucky because they had a lot of the furniture already there, and on our budget, it really helped us. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of course, we augmented the production design with our own furnishes, but we were able to use the bones of that, and it saved what you can imagine is a lot of money.
Right.
And way back when, that estate belonged to one of the most hated men in America during the Gilded Age. He was a notorious short seller and would make up, you know, lies about companies to just line his pockets. So we look up to him. Thankfully, those days are over.
Yeah. Yeah,
of course, long behind us.
Yes.
So you've done other films. I'm not familiar with your other work, but I did see one of the notes said you like doing social commentary, and there was a lot of social commentary in this one. But it didn't hit you over the head. So what types of things do you like to do?
So this is my third. This is Joseph and I. This is our first time working together. Yeah. My last film was The God Committee, which was a medical thriller set in the world of organ transplantation, starring Kelsey Grammer and Julia Stiles and Coleman Domingo. Hardcore drama, so different, but still speaking to, social issues as well. Yeah.
And so you say this isn't a pandemic movie, but I would kind of, and just as a viewer, I saw it.
I wanted to comment on this because I was thinking about this recently.
He's wrong, right?
I mean, partially. Like, we don't like to think about it as we view it as much more than a pandemic.
Right.
I think that's the right way.
Yeah.
Because it's really about how divided America is and class warfare.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there are numerous parallels to the pandemic and that's when we wrote it. And in a way, it's strange because I think that the time that we've had since COVID has allowed people to look at it in a very different way, and it makes our film read differently suddenly. Mm-hmm. Like, because we have that distance, and a lot of us are like, oh my God, that was such a weird time.
Right?
Because now we're not wearing our masks in airports, on planes. Yep. I was thinking about this yesterday, and it really, you know, instead of making our film feel dated, it makes it... It adds another layer of like interpretation to it all, which I find really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Right.
to qualify the pandemic thing, I would say.
Oh, now he's
going to
back
down. I'm going to double down. I'd say to the extent that broad scale emergencies have a way of betraying the fault lines of the class system in America, it is a pandemic movie or a disaster type of movie. And it you know, what it does is it kind of exposes the central dependence that the wealthy have on the working class. And we, you know, and again, this is a comedy, and it's meant to be enjoyed. And
it scared the hell out of me. Yeah.
As the best comedies do.
Right? Yeah, right.
All right. Well, I'm sorry. We've got to have to wrap up.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for coming in. Yeah,
thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
I have another line here to deliver.
Yeah, let it go.
Okay. That was Austin Stark and Joseph Schumann, the co-directors of Coup, which is playing tonight at 8:30 right here at the Barrymore. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're at the Bartel. Right here at the Bartel.
It's playing at the Barrymore.
It's playing at the Barrymore.
Have you
been to the Barrymore?
I have it.
It's great. You'll love it. Yeah.
Right over there at the Barrymore.
All right. We'll be there, I think.
Thanks, guys.
We hope.
I hope so.
Our next film is Out of the Picture. Many documentaries have been made about artists, but Out of the Picture is the first documentary film to be made about art critics in the United States. Let's hear a little clip from that.
When I came here 11 years ago, there were 4 full-time critics just in Seattle, and there was one at the Oregonian. I believe there's now just me, and that means there's now 0.
Small and medium-sized newspapers are looking at the possibility of extinction.
The downside of mid-sized and small American cities not having arts reported is that they're going to be more marginalized in the conversation.
If the whole American discourse about the arts is controlled by 6 people in New York City, that's a limited perspective.
Joining us today to talk about Out of the Picture is the director, Mary Louise Schumacher. Schumacher?
Yes, Schumacher.
Okay. Right. So
hi, guys.
You're not a shoemaker.
No.
Okay, good. So, and award-winning journalist and art critic based in Milwaukee. Welcome.
Yeah, I'm actually based in Portland, Maine now.
So oh, you are.
The critic at the Journal Sentinel for 18 years,
but sweet.
I just recently moved to Maine.
He goes to Maine. I go to Maine every year.
Well, come and visit.
Yep. Oh, I will. We have friends all up and down the coast, so spend a lot of time in Whitefield.
And this is Maine today here.
Yes, we'll be spending more time.
Nice B&Bs there. So this is a movie about critics. Now, I didn't get to see the movie. I didn't have access to it. But I did. There's a pretty lengthy trailer. So
correct.
I got a feel for it.
Yeah.
So what's...
Why in the world did you make a movie about art critics?
That's a really good question. That,
so. Yeah, I mean, so as I said, I was a critic, a visual arts critic at the Journal Sentinel Milwaukee for a really long time. And, you know, about 10, 12 years ago, critics just started losing their jobs across the country. And I obviously cared about that, was wondering what that would mean, what it would mean for communities like our own to just sort of suddenly lose all of those witnesses to what artists do. And I wanted to figure out how to tell that story. You know, my journalistic instincts sort of kicked in. Mm-hmm. And in the art world, there were all of these kind of long-standing, mind-numbing panel discussions about the crisis of criticism that were just horrible and never went anywhere and made you want to like stab yourself in the thigh with a fork.
Right.
And then in the world of media, there was a bigger discussion about the demise of media generally, the collapse and the downward pressure on the field. And so the plight of the little art critic was just not important to anybody. Mm. And it's also a pretty esoteric subject, right? So I was literally having coconut pancakes at the River West Co-op in Milwaukee with my friend Mark, and I was like, how can I tell this story in a way that will actually connect with the average human? Mm-hmm. And we cooked up this crazy notion that we should make a movie and just turn our cameras, pick a bunch of writers, turn our cameras on them, and just see what happened. So that's what we did about 12 years ago. And we just, you know, we watched what happened to them. And what we didn't expect, really, was that our cameras would roll during this time when everything about art and everything about media completely changed. Mm-hmm. And so the film, in a lot of ways, is as much about this time of change we're all living through as it is kind of what the state of criticism is today.
And kind of underlines the importance of criticism in culture, I guess, popular culture and unpopular culture. And it helps to have an intermediary, doesn't it?
A translator, right, for sure. And especially now, like you think about, we all, like, we're sitting here with these devices, sitting, you know, we've got our phones sitting here on the table, right? Like, all of us have visual culture just, like, coming at us like a fire hose, right?
Right.
And discerning, like, what's actually artful, what's worthy of our attention is, like, not so easy, right? Yeah. A lot of it's very sophisticated. But, you know, like, what should we really care about? Like, having somebody say, you know, look at this. This has really got meaning, and we should give it some attention. Mm-hmm. So yes, I think that pathfinding role of the critic is more important than ever. And I think the thing that's changed and the thing I learned from, you know, I picked writers I loved and cared about for this film. That's who I wanted to follow if I was going to do this. And I wanted to learn from them. I wanted to, you know, understand a field that was collapsing just as I was coming into it. And I think the thing that a lot of these writers who are in this film do, that critics in the past did not do, is they write about the world broadly through the lens of art. They don't go to a museum and just write about, like, the painting that is on the wall.
The painting was pretty.
Right. Yes, right. They're writing about politics and migration and race and economics and all of these things through the lens of what artists are doing in the world today. And it just means they're in the center of our really important conversation, these critics, you know?
You said that when you started this, it was during this 10 or 12 year process, everything changed. And what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that many things have changed. Obviously, media has been decimated, right? There's no guarantees of it, of its future, much of it, really. We don't know how daily newspapers are going to survive outside of two or three that are now kind of national publications. So that's kind of the obvious thing. In terms of culture, you know, the tools that used to be kind of rare and for the artist, the tools of making, are now in almost everybody's back pocket. And so the world has become a much more image and culture-driven society. So again, there's that fire hose I'm talking about. We're all makers. We've got all this stuff coming at us all the time. And yet, you know, I don't know if you know John Berger, the old art critic from the UK, would always talk about kind of the aura of art. There's a lot out there that has kind of the look and the feel of art, the aura of art, but it doesn't really do the job of art. And so that's what's changed. We're flooded with visual information and culture, but very little of it is, you know, really worth kind of taking in and thinking about and bringing full circle your thinking about it to write about it as a critic. So I think that's
What about? I mean, and also, I think we're all expected to have opinions on everything all the time. I mean, I went to Taco Bell one day and I got an email from, you know, Google saying, "Do you want to rate your visit to Taco Bell?" It's like, no.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, one of the reasons critics get such a bad rap is they're just sort of lumped into this, like, you know, the world of negativity that we all live in online now too. You know, like, you think about what drives a lot of these spaces where we consume media and information. It's algorithms that are driven by things like weirdness and outrage and anger and negativity. And so critics sort of get lumped into this category of, like, the dropkick, the you know, I don't want to use bad language on the air, but you know, like, the jerks who have horrible things to say. But, you know, the job of the critic is really to slow down and take something in deeply and bring their thinking all the way into some kind of a conclusion and have something of their own to add to that conversation. So the artist makes something, has some insight about the world to share, and the critic offers insight in response. That is not something that happens quickly. It's not something that happens easily. And it is not something that happens online every day as much as the, like, thumbs up and thumbs down.
It needs to be a well-considered conversation between the critic and the artist.
Yeah.
Or you could just like it or not like
it. Right, just thumbs up. Give it 5 stars instead of 4.
Yeah, for sure.
Full disclosure, I used to do movie reviews a long time ago for a small newspaper. I was really bad at it. But it was for a newspaper, somebody had to do it. And I got.
Were you on staff?
I got free tickets. But I ticked off the movie people in town one time when at one of my reviews, and they pulled their advertising because they were so mad at me. That was probably the last one I reviewed.
Oh, my goodness.
Car wash.
It was something like that. It was Mankato, so we didn't get any good movies.
Well, and that speaks, you had power, right?
Right, yeah. Right.
You know, and that's also the question, like, do critics have power anymore? Like, there's, you know, that's an... It's an open question. Mm-hmm. A lot of people would say not so much.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, that's everywhere. Like, you know, I mean, newspaper editorials and op-eds used to be something people read and talked about and discussed. Yeah. Now everybody's got an opinion on everything. So
it's disintermediated.
They just throw their crap out and, you know, and it's one idea is as good as another, you know.
Right.
I mean, we see that in a lot of different
There's a very flattening effect on media and opinion that we receive, which is all the more reason to have, like, those handful of voices you really want to listen to and go back to and, you know, find those places where you can locate them and take them in on a regular basis.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Thanks. Mary Louise Schumacher.
You're so welcome.
She's out of the picture. It's having its U.S. debut tonight at the Chazen Museum of Art at 8:15. Thank you so much for coming in. It was great
to
meet you.
Thanks for having me, guys.
All right, before we go to our next film, we have to take a quick break and play some announcements.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and the Wine and Hop Shop, located at 1919 Monroe Street, specializing in home brewing and winemaking supplies for over 40 years. Open to in-person shopping or order online for curbside pickup, in Madison delivery and shipping of supplies at wineandhop.com.
Support for this program comes from WORT's listener sponsors and Isthmus Newspaper. Isthmus is back on newsstands the first Thursday of every month, and now a nonprofit. Isthmus continues to expand its independent coverage of local government, the arts, and all things Madison at isthmus.com.
All right, we're back. That was your line. I just stepped on you.
That's okay.
Our next film, we're not used to working with a script, so our next film's coming to us from Tomah, Wisconsin. February is about a young Mexican man who arrives in Wisconsin in the dead of winter. It's taking him a while to settle in, but then he learns about ice fishing. Here's a short clip from February.
Help you with that?
What is this?
It's a tip up for ice fishing.
Ice fishing?
Not from around here, are you? Well, at least you're learning the language. Most of your people don't.
How do you use this?
A tip up? Go to a library, fella. We just sell clothes here.
Okay, joining us to talk about February is director Nathan Deming. Welcome, Nathan.
Hi, Mel. Hi, Floyd. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
So, I want to talk about the cinematography first, because you guys made Tomo look pleasant.
I'm born and raised. We have the busiest McDonald's in the state.
So, really?
Put some respect on our
All right, name. I take that back.
Yeah.
I take that back.
So why do you have the busiest McDonald's in the state?
We're right where the I divides.
Oh, right.
So, yeah. All the buses stop there on the way to Minneapolis. Gotcha. Yeah.
But the other thing I really liked, the lead actor, David Ezekiel Duran, who spent the first half of the movie not saying anything.
Right.
He did not say one word, did not have a line until pretty much the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And you could just feel the weight of his situation.
Yeah.
It was really moving and really... was pleased with it.
Cool.
And here I am again, waxing fanboy.
But no, it's nice to hear. And David, I should mention, was supposed to be here today, and his flight got canceled, so that's a bummer.
Yeah, but, that's too bad. I was hoping to meet him, get a picture with him, you know, put it on my bulletin board.
So, give the listeners just a little taste of what the movie's about.
So,
we saw it, but
I'm trying to do a 12 film cycle about life in Wisconsin, based on the months of the year. So 2 years ago, I was here with a film called January, and this is February. Mm-hmm. You can guess what comes
next.
And the idea is, this is something I can do throughout my career on the side of other projects, and just kind of like love letters to Wisconsin and our state, I guess, and just reflect different aspects of life here. And the first episode, January, is about a completely different character, this 75-year-old church volunteer who's pretty cranky about a shotgun wedding happening in her small church.
Is that in Tomo also? Or?
It's kind of a nameless small town. Okay. Yeah. She actually pops up for a second. She's the torta lady in February.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is a torta?
Yeah, exactly. So she's the main character of January. So that's the idea, too, is they all kind of like intersect and just kind of explore completely different people. Who still share a complete, you know, like a community and common life. Mm-hmm.
It's a shared universe.
Yeah. It's a little, my little superhero metaverse or whatever.
But this one is about people who've moved to Tomo from Mexico.
Yes, or? I should say. Yeah, so February is specifically about a new arrival to Tomo. Or the name was small town. Miguel, he's joining a family of people who've been there a little bit longer. His sister's family clearly has been there for a little bit. Mm-hmm. But slightly outsiders at first, right? And he's trying to get used to the place, get comfortable. And it really takes him a while until discovering ice fishing. Mm-hmm. And once he does that, he runs into the other kind of lead of the film, Carl, who, if I could say, is a non-actor. I was really proud of his performance. He just answered a Craigslist ad. I don't know what you guys thought of him. I thought he was
great.
Yeah,
he was
fantastic. Great. Right. Like, I thought he did so
kind of
good.
Kind of the gruff Wisconsin guy.
Yeah. So that's the second half of the movie, right? Is their unpredictable night together out on the ice.
Mm-hmm.
So why is ice fishing this metaphor or whatever you want to call it?
That's a good question. I was writing it and I got really entranced by it. It's such a unique experience, right? And it kind of goes along, I think, with like hunting is also this very meditative, like hunters will tell you, it's often not just about actually getting the animal, it's about the peace and the quiet and the connection with nature. And this one I kind of wanted to build, I don't know if you guys felt this, but I wanted to build the experience of, at least from Miguel's point of view, he's kind of trapped in a lot of noisy environments for the first half of the film. And there is no refuge when it's cold in the state, right? Like, you know, you have your house or your apartment or wherever. So ice fishing is also a very appealing escape. And while we were filming there, we filmed that on the ice. It was a very surreal experience and so cool to see just so many other ice tents, ice shacks just out there, going, doing their thing.
I heard you were worried about the warm weather now, the warmer winters we have, that you actually couldn't drive out on the ice.
Or? Oh, well, we filmed it a year ago, luckily.
Right.
And then this winter, we would have been out of luck, which is like...
Would have been
hard to imagine.
Water.
Yeah, it would have been. But actually, we even got lucky. Like, our last day, it jumped up to 50 degrees, which made us nervous, but also, like, it's nicer.
You got to be outside filming.
But not when you're driving a couple vans and trucks out on the ice. So
I also really liked the casting of the trout. I thought.
Was that really a trout, or were they just playing a trout?
It was a tilapia playing trout.
Yeah.
So do you ice fish, or did you grow up ice fishing?
I did not grow up ice fishing, yeah. And actually Richie, who plays Carl, he introduced me to all of it. And,
So he's like, a legitimate ice
fisher. Oh, he's fisher. A legitimate. Yeah, I put a Craigslist ad just saying.
He knows what a tip-up is and all that.
Yeah, like, yeah. I just put up this ad saying, would any ice fisherman consider, you know, being in a movie? And his wife actually responded saying, this is my husband, LOL, and sent me
she
a picture.
She was just trying to get him out of the house.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
He's an ice fisherman. He's always out of the house.
Can I say something about the cinematography since
sure.
you brought it up?
Yes.
I felt so lucky to work with this AFI grad named Leo Perman, who's from Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. We turned out to be good friends after this, and he just did a fantastic job. I don't know what you guys thought our budget was, but it was not very much.
Right.
And he
right.
just did a fantastic job, I think, of making it look like a real movie.
Right, it did look like a real movie. It looked like you totally. Had a budget.
Yeah.
I was watching it the day we got our snowstorm this week, and then it opened up, and they're like talking about how cold it is, they're plowing the roads, and it's like, I don't want to watch this because I was already surly about this. Yeah.
I have a neighbor up north. I've got a cabin up north, and I go and
he's
hang out in the winter. And he's an ice fisherman, so okay. I will go down and watch ice fishing.
Okay.
I bring the Jägermeister.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We, stand and chat, and I've got some.
What's the difference between ice fishing and watching ice fishing?
That's true.
Watching ice fishing is much better than actually ice fishing. You don't stand the risk of failure. you can just go in when it gets cold.
I was surprised how warm it is, like, 'cause Richie took me out the week before we started filming, and it was like minus 10 or something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're all bundled up, and then we get in, and he just pops on one of those little, like, burners, right? The little gas canisters.
Right.
And we were down to, like, our shirts in, like, 10
in the
minutes.
Tent?
Yeah, in the tent. Yeah. It was fine. Yeah.
It's just all the excitement and anticipation.
Yes, it was the fit. We were excited.
I thought you did capture the essence of ice fishing, though, with that they were just sitting there drinking beer and on the cooler.
Yeah. And watching the bobber, waiting for something to happen.
Yeah.
When I used to go fishing, I would always hope to not catch anything because it would just disturb me. I was like, I was enjoying being out on the boat and the waves. And it's like, I don't want this. It's annoying. So I started fishing without putting bait, so I wouldn't. Well, I was with friends. I didn't want to embarrass myself.
Oh, okay.
I said,
you
want to fish? Yeah, I'll fish. So what's March going to be about?
No spoilers. You'll find out.
Oh my God! it's holding out.
It might have something to do with the changing of the seasons, though.
Yeah.
That would make sense.
A little spoiler.
Yeah.
Some geese
and then April
might show
could
up.
Be another snowstorm.
This year, yeah.
And then there's Packer season. That's like half of the year.
Yeah,
Then you only have to make like 4 movies.
So. Go a lot faster.
Yeah.
All right, we better wrap up here pretty quick. Yes. So thank you for coming in, Nathan Deming, right?
Yes. So nice to meet you guys. Thanks for highlighting
the
film.
And that was Nathan Deming from the Badger Award. You won an award.
Oh, you won a Golden Badger?
You
won a Golden Badger. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
The Badger Award-winning film, February.
Do you get like a stuffed badger for that, or what do you,
no,
you
it's
get?
An actual golden
you get
badger.
A little golden badger. It rocks.
Yeah,
it's a little bucky.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
It's playing 2 p.m. on Sunday at the Marquee at Union South.
That's right.
Our final film is Film is Dead, Long Live Film. The documentary mixes in in-depth interviews with film collectors and restorationists and rich images recovered from nitrate and safety film. Let's hear a clip.
Let me give you my theory on film collectors of my generation, which is admittedly most collectors. We've handled film for so long that its molecules have become fused with ours. And we've become part film. As a matter of fact, we've become movie monsters. Film, film, give me film. I want film. And that's really what film collecting is. One long monster movie.
Joining us to talk about Film is Dead, Long Live Film, is director Peter Flynn.
Hello.
Hi, Peter.
Hello. Hi. Good thanks for having
you.
Me.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
To be here.
Good to see you again. Peter was here about an hour ago.
we sent him off to the old-fashioned for a fish fry.
Did you find a coffee shop? Or
I found a... Yes, I did.
Okay.
I did, yes. Good.
Very
happy. Very good.
So this movie is about kind of obsessive odd people who collect little bits of film, right?
Or hoard film.
That's a way of putting it. Yes.
I have to admit to the critic that I used to be a movie reviewer, and I have to admit to you that when I was a kid, I was one of those people. I had a little 8mm projector, and I had a bunch of, you know, that one scene where they're showing the little boxes with the Bride of Frankenstein and House of Horses. I had dozens and dozens. I had all the Universal monsters, and then a bunch of Charlie Chaplin stuff.
So you know what it was like as a kid to have that.
It was great. I'd have little shows in my basement for my buddies.
Fantastic.
But I didn't charge any money. That one guy charged a quarter. that sort of offended me.
But something saved you from that mania.
I branched off into this, I guess. I'd get stuff from Blackhawk. They were in Iowa somewhere, I think.
Right.
And then Castle Films.
That's
and then
right,
there was someplace called Niles.
There were so many, and that was the entry point for so many of that boomer generation of collectors.
I kind of jumped in the middle of this, but tell us what's going on in this documentary.
Well, it's a documentary, as you said, about film collectors, and really what it's about, it's about the wealth of film history and heritage that wouldn't exist today were it not for collectors, people who held on to this when everybody else was junking it, when everybody else was abandoning it. A certain subsection of our population dove into those dumpsters and rescued these films. And if it wasn't for that, they wouldn't be here today. So it's a celebration of these people who've never been given acknowledgement for a crucial role in maintaining and preserving film history.
Right. And it's inherently time limited. Activity, because what they're collecting, of course, is deteriorating.
Well, what they're collecting is deteriorating, and of course, the vast majority of collectors are advancing in age, so they're going. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at the end of this. I think it's a lovely subculture and a lovely kind of a very unique kind of cinephilia mm-hmm. that I think will be going away in the next couple of years. So I felt very privileged to be able to capture what I was able to capture in this documentary. Yeah.
So where did these people find these lost movies?
In all kinds of places. You know, you have to understand that the studios who made these films really foresaw a very limited lifespan. So mm-hmm. after, you know, an initial run, these films were destined to be destroyed or recycled. And if they fell through the cracks, they were just discarded and forgotten, left behind in theaters. So if you were a collector back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, you would find film prints in the old film depots. You would find film prints in the basement and attics of movie theaters. You would find them in dumpsters. You'd find them behind the dumpster of a movie theater or a film depot or a studio.
I love some of the scenes where they went to old drive-ins.
Yeah,
and I didn't realize that they still had the film in the drawers.
It's kind of amazing.
And these guys are digging through, and they'd get excited because they'd find like a 20-second clip of the animation of "Let's go to the lobby." And, you know, it's like a hot dog and a Coke, and they're jumping around. Yeah. And it's like, go
and
to the lobby.
And that hot dog jumped right into the bun.
That was a little salacious.
Sorry, it's a family show.
Now, of course, that's the familiar stuff. That's what we're familiar with. But you know, so much of what's been found is very unique and very rare and a lot of wonderful stuff that you see in this film that again would not survive
and the restoration efforts, which just astounded.
Well, I think a lot of these people now coming to the end of their careers as collectors and looking around and seeing digital really having made obsolete all this technology and all these films, feel that need more urgently than ever before to somehow pass it on to the next generation. And in some cases, that means digitizing it. In other cases, it means getting it to an archive who will take proper care of it. So I think all of the people that are featured in this film, or almost all of them, are very intent on passing this along.
Mm-hmm. One thing I noticed with the different people you interviewed, that they all seemed a little kind of quirky, and they kind of like wanted to get some attention. Like whenever they were on film, they would maybe do a bow or do a little dance or something. So they were, I don't know if they were frustrated performers or what.
You think that, well, that's always an element with documentary film, is that you're putting a camera on somebody and you're saying, I value
do
you.
Something.
I think you're terrific. Yeah. And I think that engages a sense of enthusiasm for them. And I think for a lot of the people in this film, the power of the projector, the ability to entertain a group of people was what drew them to it, and what gave them a sense of identity and personality. And so I think once the camera is turned on them, I think that natural showmanship, for want of a better term, comes out in a lot of them. Yes.
Did you see about a month ago they found an old Clara Bow movie?
Yes.
Like
it was
in Omaha or something.
Right.
Some odd
and
place.
Every day new stuff is being found. Every day. But it's more and more the stuff we're finding is being found in archives that's just hasn't been labeled or gotten to yet. The material that's out in the wild, as it were, is getting less and less and less. Mm-hmm.
And it's steadily deteriorating.
And steadily deteriorating, that's right, yeah.
So I'm watching this. I mean, I felt this. They would show some of these old movies, and you'd kind of get a little tingle. It's like, oh, that's really cool. But at the time, they were just more or less junk. I mean, they were schlock. It was like, let's throw this crap out here.
Disposable.
Right.
Yes.
Kids. Yep. And I mean, we've seen that in a lot of things, like comic books.
Of course. And, yesterday's junk is today's
music.
Treasure.
I mean, who thought we'd be listening to some of this music, 50, 60 years later? It was supposed to be just totally disposable.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that was the same thing. Yeah. But somehow over time, it transforms into something more.
It transforms into something more. And aren't we better and richer as a culture and as a community for having a lot of this, this older? I mean, there are many films that you see in my documentary that may very well be the only evidence that certain people and certain places ever existed on this planet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So to be able to hold on to that, I think is quite lovely, to say, here, this person was in this place at this moment in time. The place and the person are gone, mm-hmm. and all living memory of that person and place are gone. But here it is on a strip of film.
I love, there was one scene where they were looking at a piece of film and they were trying to figure out, what year it was from. Uh-huh. And somebody said, well, when did men quit wearing hats? Because the men all had hats on there.
A lot. And I think that's part of the thrill for collectors. It's that ability of going out and finding something and then being able to determine what it was and where it was and what the value and significance of it is.
But I mean, some of this...
Kennedy, wasn't it? Kennedy who stopped wearing
hats? Kennedy.
That's right.
There was one guy who was so thrilled to find the robot monster movie. Yes. And that's it's a famous one because it's got that silly monster with the guy in the ape suit, and then he's got like a TV on his head or something.
Right.
But he was very excited about it.
There's an example of a film that everybody knows because it's out on YouTube,
it's
and you can find very bad quality copies of it. But here is a pristine copy that was found that we're able to now present in 3D in as good, if not better, quality as when it was first issued in the 1950s. So people can look at that film again now, fresh for the first time, which is exciting.
Yeah.
Are you involved
It's still not a good film, but it looks great.
It looks
fantastic. Yeah.
What surprised me is that I think about this as like old movies, mostly silent movies, and from that era. But they were talking about like more current movies are disintegrating, like Star Wars and
exactly.
Close Encounters.
Yes, I mean,
so
you
I thought we were better nowadays.
I thought we were better than that.
Well, the fundamental chemistry on that flexible piece of plastic is not meant to last. It's simply that's the simple fact. And the first thing to go is the color. Then the next thing to go is the flexibility. And once it loses its flexibility, it can no longer run through a projector. And then past a certain point, it can no longer run through a digital scanner. And then it's completely lost. Mm, it's lost forever. Yeah. So, the materiality, the physicality of this stuff, like our own, is just not built to last.
No wonder I can relate.
It's falling apart.
It's falling apart, yes.
Were you involved? There's a Jerry Lewis movie in this... Were you involved in that at all?
Funny you should mention it.
We only got about 30 seconds.
Not directly involved, but one of the restorationists who found the robot monster print was a personal archivist to Jerry Lewis, and he's featured in the documentary, and he's brought this Jerry Lewis print to screen here. So I think it follows right after my documentary.
The disorderly orderly.
Oh, the disorderly orderly.
Yes.
He's on duty tonight. I remember that.
Well, thank you so much. This has been delightful. We've been talking to Peter Flynn. Peter's the director of Film is Dead, Long Live Film, which is showing tomorrow, Saturday, April 6th at 1:15 at the UW Cinematheque.
All right. I guess that does it for us for the day. Do I have lines here?
I don't know. We got to get out of here.
Time I should have been off book by
time
now.
Time to declare. Did you bring your whistle?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Declare the... Ooh, that's a good one. It's the weekend, so enjoy your weekend. Floyd, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
All of our guests. It was great fun.
It was great fun.
Thanks to Ruby and Elmer and Gladys, and thanks to Super Dave for engineering back at the station. A huge thank you to the Wisconsin Film Festival, and thanks to all of you for listening and some folks getting down here to see us at the Bartel.
Live audience.
It's They're sort of alive. They're not lively.
No. But that's all we ask.
That's right. So, it's a little before 2 o'clock, and you're listening to WRT 89.9 FM Madison. Up next is the kiosk, and who cooks for you with the real Jaguar? Have a good week, everybody. Bye-bye.
Have a good week. Bye.
You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Friday, April 5th.
If your home or business is suddenly being engulfed in flames, you count on a quick response from the fire department. But who rushes to aid firefighters when so many of the burning buildings they enter are contaminated with chrysotile asbestos, a cancer-causing product so deadly that it's banned in over 50 countries? This nasty toxic, widely used in construction materials, car parts, and even water systems, infiltrates lungs and kills some 40,000 Americans a year, especially firefighters. For the last 30 years, victims, health advocates, and others have been pushing to stop using the deadly stuff. But chemical profiteers and the politicians they pay kept defeating these efforts. In 2016, though, Congress finally empowered the EPA to ban it. Great! But that same year, Trump happened. With his usual deep analysis, concern for workers, and respect for science, he mindlessly proclaimed asbestos 100% safe, even declaring that the movement to ban it was led by the mob. Thus, his EPA did nothing, and deaths continued. Then came Joe Biden, and hallelujah, EPA has now announced that it is, quote, finally slamming the door on manufacturing, importing, and using chrysotile asbestos. When? 12 years from now. What? Yes, that's a very slow motion slamming. Biden wanted the ban to take effect in 2 years, but industry lobbyists screeched, so our government chose not to rush to aid firefighters and